Thank you, and thanks for the invitation to let me visit and stay here and speak. So this is essentially a cosmology talk, quantum cosmology, and it will be based on work with Jim and with Stephen Hawking. Some of it is published in these papers, but the most interesting part is not, which may not be uncommon. And this will be the title of the next paper, I think. So here's an outline. I will first briefly describe why we need quantum cosmology and what you can do once you have a wave function. And then I apply these ideas to a concrete model in which I first evaluate the wave function in a mini-superspace approximation, restricting to homogeneous and isotropic universes. And then we include perturbations. So once you have your wave function in these approximations, then you have probabilities for different cosmologies, different histories. But it is rather subtle the way these probabilities are related to actual probabilities for observations. And so I'll explain that, and this is really the central part of our work. So then we apply the same framework, including perturbations. And I will end on a lighter note discussing some applications to more general models and implications for the arrow of time in these universes. So first of all, why do we need quantum cosmology? Well, the short answer is to get physics out of the landscape. Okay? So of course, the landscape is not a random collection of vacua. It is their constraints, their correlations, their relative abundances that can be calculated. But the string landscape itself does not explain us why we are in one vacuum rather than in another. And even if you believe you are in one particular vacuum, the landscape itself, of course, does not tell you how you got there and why you got there. And furthermore, in a cosmological context, all these vacua in the landscape have generically past singularities, and therefore really to predict you're in one or another, you need a theory or a framework that resolves these singularities and that assigns probabilities or relative probabilities to different possible cosmologies that lead to one or another vacuum. Okay, so that has been, of course, those questions have been around since the Big Bang, since people came up with the idea of the Big Bang, at least, right? But they have become more important, I think, with the recent landscape developments in string theory. In fact, to quote Gary Gibbons in Cambridge last year, the absence of priors challenges our basic notions of science, he says, right? Because without a prior probability distribution on these possible cosmologies, it's very hard to get predictions. So then, I should say, that's a comment devoted to David, that this talk is not about the precise formulation of the quantum state. Okay, that's an equally important, or maybe even a more important program, but that's a different talk. In this talk, I will adopt Jim and Stephen's idea, Jim and Stephen's proposal for a quantum state, and I will regard it as a toy model of whatever quantum state string theory will eventually provide us with. And the motivation for doing so is that a concrete state will enable us to illustrate what sort of predictions you get out of this once you have a quantum state. And so that's what we're interested in today. What cosmologies are possible? What are their probabilities? And how do you get probabilities for observation? How do you test your theory? So this is in the end, of course, from working with a toy model, you might hope to learn something about a more precise formulation. But all I can say about this at this point judging from our results is that the situation is, at least within a boundary state, similar to DSCFT. And so what I can say about this does not differ from Maldacena's remarks in his paper on non-Gaussianity on DSCFT, where he says that if there is a dual CFT description, the CFT will not be defined on one geometry. Okay, it will be defined on a range of geometries, because you have to integrate over a range of geometries, final geometries, in order to get probabilities for observations. Something very similar is happening in the no-boundary framework, but of course there's no dual CFT. Okay, so for this talk I'm going to have faith in the semi-classical approximation to the no-boundary wave function, which is accurate in certain regions of superspace. And in that approximation, the wave function simply takes this form, where this is the action of a extremal geometry, which, because of the irregularity condition imposed, that the no-boundary wave function imposes, the geometry will be complex. The wave function is a function of real boundary data, but the regularity at the south pole requires the extremal geometry to be complex. So the action of the semi-classical no-boundary wave function will have a real and an imaginary part, necessarily. That the Euclidean action will have a real and an imaginary part. Okay, so once you have this, then the semi-classical wave function specifies classical Lorentzian histories, cosmologies, when in addition the classicality condition holds. The classicality condition requires that the gradient of the imaginary part of the Euclidean action is much larger than the gradient of the real part. If that is the case, then it follows from the Wheeler-DeWitt equation that the imaginary part of the Euclidean action approximately obeys the Lorentzian Hamiltonian Jacobi equation, and therefore the histories that you get are predicted just to be the integral curves of that imaginary part. The probabilities of those histories are then given by the real part of the Euclidean action, which along these integral curves is necessarily preserved. Okay, so that is the general framework in simple terms at the semi-classical, in the semi-classical approximation. So, when you have this, then you get an ensemble of Lorentzian histories in different regions of mini-superspace, and each history is labeled by a point in classical phase space, but you don't get every history in this approximation, okay? Because there is a constraint. Because there is a constraint, you only get a restricted set of classical histories out of this. So therefore, the no-boundary wave function, and for that matter any quantum state, will provide you with a slice through phase space. In the semi-classical approximation, the probability of all other cosmologies is zero. There, zero. And so what I will do in a concrete model later in this talk is to calculate explicitly that slice. And there's no reason why you can't do that in a more general model. So in that sense, in the semi-classical approximation, we have a measure on classical phase space, because each dot on that slice has a well-defined probability. So one important point, which is implicit in what I said already, so I said that when the classicality condition holds, in other words, when you have a classical cosmology, then this is given by the Lorentzian, its evolution is given by the Lorentzian field equations. So, but that means it's different from the geometries that we use to extremize the action of to get the no-boundary wave function. Okay, so those geometries, when you evolve these back from the surface at which you evaluate the wave function, they can do all sorts of things. They can bounce in the path, they can be singular, whatever, they can recollapse in the future. So we will find those cosmologies in this model. But the important point I want to make here, these histories, these Lorentzian cosmologies, are distinct from the complex extrema that we used to provide a semi-classical approximation to the wave function. So you can just think of the no-boundary wave function as assigning a probability to all possible real cosmologies. The crucial point being that even though some of these cosmologies are singular, this singularity does not prevent you from predicting probabilities for observables. Okay? Because any observable you wish to calculate on that surface, you calculate from the wave function, imposing regularity and so forth. In other words, the singularity, even if it's there sometimes, it's not an obstacle to prediction. So in some sense, well, in a very important sense, I would say, this resolves the singularity.
But I understand what you're saying, and I agree that it's not an obstacle to prediction. But sometimes when people talk about resolving singularities, they mean something very different.
Yes. Right? So it does not resolve the singularity if you want to know what's happening there. Yeah. So that,
the physics,
right, what is breaking down? Just the same classical approximation of the wave function, and therefore the whole formalism. But it's, yes, that's right. So in that sense, it does not resolve the singularity if you want to go there.
But is this saying that...
But it's very different from in GR, where you can't compute anything or from anything...
I would have said it's the same as in GR.
Yeah, it's the same as in GR, but...
You're not proposing initial conditions, you're proposing sort of an intermediate condition.
Yeah, yeah, that's
starting
right.
Starting the thing
right
after the singularity.
But there's something more going on. I mean, you're saying that you can predict in a reliable way, using only semi-classical methods, what the probabilities are for
right
space-times that are singular in the past.
Right.
So in some sense, the probability for this universe to be, or for us to be in a universe, is independent of any of the microphysics taking place near the singularity. That's a prediction or something.
It's prediction of this wave function.
Of this way of calculating.
Yeah, yeah. It's
often used, though, for disintegral-like spaces where there wasn't even a classically at that singularity. I mean, does it...
It's being used, you say, or...
I mean, the canonical example is a disintegral space-time where the past history was collapsed and expanded. Well, some coordinate system was collapsed and expansion.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
sure.
But I guess it also makes predictions for our universe where,
right,
if you do classical backward motion, would give you a singularity.
Yes, yes, yes. In fact, those de Sitter universes perturb them significantly. There's an open set of those cosmologies, so to speak, which are non-singular.
Yes.
And in fact, we will see these coming up.
But are you going to also apply it to universes like ours, which are classically singular in the past?
I don't think our universe is necessarily classically singular in the past.
Didn't somebody prove that?
Right, I will come to this.
But so you're saying that
every proof has its assumptions.
Had a microscopic theory of the singularity, and we could really study the physics near the singularity. Are you saying that it could never, even in principle, make a prediction that would prefer, you know, one universe over another based on the physics near the singularity?
Oh, no, not at all, because I think when you understand the physics near the singularity, you might have a microscopic description of... You will have to make a choice of quantum states there.
No, but where did that... Okay, so this no boundary is a particular quantum state. And
I think...
allows you to do the
state has been chosen.
Right, which is the same as, roughly speaking, as... saying what the microphysics is. We're not calculating the microphysics. In principle, it's possible to do that. So
I think this is what
brain description in which it's classical.
So in this state, you can make the prediction.
Right,
so
right.
It's about the same.
Yeah. It's very much the same. The difference is just that I think there is a... So I think there is certainly room for a precise formulation, and I think this will involve the physics at the singularity. But this is yeah, much more a proposal which on general grounds, I guess.
But this statement is maybe more familiar in a different language. It's the same statement. If you assume you've got a no-boundary wave function, and you want to compute the corrections to that from, say, higher curvature terms, well, if you have no-boundary wave function, we're in a smooth Euclidean solution. It's got some curvature scale in it. As long as the higher derivative terms are small on that curvature scale, they don't appreciably affect the answer.
One possibility is that there's a solution with lower action, more dominant, with Planckian curvature.
Absolutely.
In that case, you have to know the physics of the singularity.
One other possibility is that the real state of the universe may or may not be a no boundary state.
Right.
Different.
Sure. So, So I'll discuss a concrete model now. And so it's clear what we want to do, right? We want to find the slice on phase space. We want to see, well, what sort of universes are these. And we want to compute probabilities for observables in these universes, these three things. So first, in the mini-superspace approximation, and then we'll include perturbations. So the model is as simple as it can be. Just gravity coupled to a cosmological constant and a scalar field. And so in mini-superspace, we have just a scale factor and the scalar field, and the same classical wave function there. There's a useful rescaling of the mass and the cosmological constant such that the field equations for the complex extrema only depend on the ratio of the mass over the cosmological constant, essentially. That's the only parameter that enters. And so you see that for realistic values of lambda and m, mu is extremely large. So that's important to bear in mind. So we have to solve these equations in the complex plane, imposing the boundary conditions at the south pole and at the boundary surface. So at the south pole, regularity implies that the scale factor vanishes, of course, that its derivative is equal to 1, and the derivative of the scalar field vanishes, which means that these regularity conditions only leave the complex value of the scalar field as a free parameter. And then you have the boundary, which happens somewhere in the complex tau plane, is the boundary, where the scalar field and the scale factor are real. So these conditions impose four real conditions, which we can hope to meet by tuning phi naught n, x, and y as parameters of the complex solutions. So that's the way that you in practice will find these complex extrema. Of course, a Lorentzian history will then be a curve in the beta chi plane. Think of beta as a function of chi. That means that associated with each Lorentzian history, we will have a curve here in terms of those parameters, say gamma as a function of phi naught. And so phi naught, really different values of phi naught, the absolute value of phi at the south pole, will label different possible histories in the ensemble. And so the way that you find the ensemble is that you pick phi naught, and then you tune the other parameters so that you meet the boundary conditions at the boundary, and so that the classicality condition holds. Okay, so this is the constraint that we impose. We ask the question, what classical universes are possible in the no-boundary state? And so, in practice, what you do is you shoot so that the real part of the Euclidean action approaches a constant at large radius that will ensure that the classicality condition holds. And so that's the result of one aspect of that tuning, namely that's the tuning of the phase of the scalar field at the south pole. And you see a clear transition there. This curve corresponds to a value of mu less than 3/2, and the other curves correspond to values of mu greater than 3/2. So I told you that mu has is very large in realistic universes, so the ensemble which is closer to our world will have a sharp boundary there, because this means that for small phi naught and mu sufficiently large, there is no tuning possible of the parameters to meet those conditions. Okay, so there's no classical solution with that value of phi naught.
What was mu again?
Mu is the ratio of the mass of the scalar field to the cosmological constant.
And so
just to be clear, you said you're matching four parameters. I mean, so V and chi are the value of the metric and the scalar field at your final slice.
Yes.
What were the other two things, the zeros?
These are the imaginary part of the scalar factor and the imaginary part of the scalar field.
Oh,
those
okay.
have to vanish. That is the difficulty, in fact. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, that's not clear here. Yeah. So it turns out that in the complex, you solve for these solutions in the complex tau plane, right? And you pick a phi naught at the south pole. And then it turns out that the most convenient way to find these solutions is to solve the equations along a contour which runs horizontally and then upwards, and to tune both the phase of phi at the south pole and the turning point x so that IR tends to a constant here. That's the a priori these solutions, the ensemble of Lorentzian solutions need not be like this, but it turns out that Lorentzian histories P as a function of chi correspond to vertical trajectories in this plane. So once you got it set up that way, your solution hits the right vertical part, so to speak.
What's the statement? Is that most one classical history for each finite
theorem? Right. So, one classical history for each finite is what you expect, because there are four parameters to meet four conditions.
Right. So there,
at
the,
most
that would allow an accountable number.
In principle.
Because in some situations, the no-boundary proposal does have the problem that there are many saddle points and you have to decide which ones to keep. Halliwell discussed this, for example.
It could be that there are higher action saddle points, which we haven't found.
Lower action saddle points.
I would doubt it. Yeah.
The gravitational action is not positive, is not bounded below, so you.
Yes, but we're imposing a constraint, right? B and chi.
Is that low?
We're not looking for round Euclidean instantons. Mm-hmm. And there, of course, I agree, you get this problem and you have negative modes. These complex geometries are like. Have a constraint on their surface. Mm-hmm. Which excludes all possible negative modes.
Okay. No. I mean, rapid conformal fluctuations of the metric away from the boundary should lower the action.
If they vanish,
you do a conformal transformation of the metric, and the action picks up a minus at omega squared p. So that's why the action's unbounded from below.
But if we lower in action histories, the question is, are the
solutions?
Right.
They may not be solutions.
Well, that's what I mean. They may not have these boundaries.
So there are low.
Well, they're configurations. If you just ask for metrics with low action, they may not satisfy any equation.
Okay. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You have to check. That's not something you can assume.
No. We scanned the whole plane. Okay. So this is an exhaustive. Wait. Here.
We're working in homogeneous isotropic mini superspaces.
Okay.
Right. Oh, so you don't have these local populations.
Right. We did, however, look for other solutions.
Well, I mean, Halliwell, I think, was also a homogeneous isotropic mini superspace.
Yeah.
Do you remember
what? But we included perturbations.
Halliwell was doing something like gravity plus a scalar, right?
So where was this paper? I forgot.
I remember the paper also.
Around 1990. It was in the context of wormholes, axiomatic wormholes. Yeah. Are you, you're not insisting that phi be real? Or are you?
No. No, not at all.
We don't expect
and I'm not looking for round instantons which indeed have negative modes.
No. Which,
so
that's a different missetting. But,
I see.
But maybe,
I don't know that. Yeah.
I think he was actually constraining on phi, the phi dot boundary.
I see. Ah, okay. I see.
Charge.
But the boundary at the boundary phi is real, right? So.
Yeah, but he was constraining the charge conjugate to phi, the momentum conjugate to phi rather than phi, which is...
No.
And in that case, that would have found a lot of...
I see. I don't know that paper. Yeah.
But you don't.
I think that within this setting, I'm quite sure that this is an exhaustive procedure to find all solutions, which obey all my restrictions.
I'm sorry. The
potential is just m squared phi squared with a cosmological constant.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
With a positive or negative? Positive.
Positive cosmological constant. Yeah, it's conservative. But. Okay, so you have this feature of the ensemble that for small phi naught and realistic values of mu, you find no solutions that obeys these criteria. But phi naught is, of course, closely related to, somewhat related to the value of the scalar field at the boundary. Certainly, if the radius is not too large. So this means that the ensemble that's predicted within the same classical approximation and in the mini superspace approximation has a boundary in the, also in the B chi plane. Okay, so there are no universes which at early times have arbitrarily small scalar field. So that's what we are saying here. The classicality constraint gives the subset of histories predicted by the no boundary wave function a boundary that excludes nearly empty universe for realistic values.
And what fails exactly? I mean, if you didn't have the phi field...
The classicality condition fails.
But if you didn't have the phi field at all, you were just doing mini superspace with the scale factor, then everything would be empty. It's a statement that in that context, there are no...
Just the cosmological constant, well, then you have one solution, yeah.
Right. But
one
is
empty
that, is
solution.
That not a, is the classicality condition failing somehow on that solution?
Right. So, of course, that is a solution. Empty the sitter space is a solution.
Right.
But you can then look for small fluctuations. Uh-huh. But you don't even have a scalar field. Imagine.
I guess what I say is the classicality condition failing for the metric or for phi?
For both together.
Both. But I think what might be interesting is you could look at the potential. Of course, this is a solution. When I'm saying there are no nearly empty universes, I'm not saying that empty de Sitter space does not exist. That is a solution. But you can wonder, what if I consider small fluctuations in the scalar field around the solution? Just keep the metric de Sitter. Go through the same procedure, and you... I'm not sure how realistic this is, but in any case, you find that for mu greater than 3/2, there are no classical solutions. So at least that's consistent with what we're finding of having a lower bound here.
This is even if the sphere is big. But I can understand that there aren't solutions when the sphere is small, because the Sitter space has minimum radius for the spheres and all of that, except by the cosmological constant.
Yeah.
You're saying even if the sphere is big, there are no solutions when the scalar field is small.
Especially when the sphere is big, right? Because then the cosmological constant is small, so mu is large.
What's wrong with the... Why are there no classical solutions for small mass fields near the Sitter space?
In order for it to be a classical solution, right? The imaginary part of the action has to very quickly compare to the real part, particularly the real part has to be constant along the trajectory. So we check, right? The whether that condition was satisfied. So it's like in perturbation theory, it's a standard sort of kind of behavior. You're below some threshold, you get damp solutions, growing solutions. Then the action can stabilize and be constant along the trajectory. Above some threshold, you get oscillating things, and it just oscillates. And it varies at roughly the same scale as the imaginary part.
So another way to ask the question, I mean, we know there are solutions where you have to sitter space and you just put a little scalar field slightly displaced from its minimum, and the scalar field oscillates into sitter space, you know, just a tiny bit. And you can do it in a homogeneous isotropic way.
Yeah.
So those classical solutions certainly exist. But you're saying they somehow don't...
Oh, yeah, but that I'm not saying. They're just not predicted by...
quantum mechanical probability,
yeah,
that, in fact, these solutions behave classically. And what that means is they're correlated in time by the classical equation solution, which is not a general feature of quantum mechanics.
These are classical solutions. I solved the classical.
Yeah, but I'm not saying that these classical solutions
don't come from this no boundary wave function.
Yeah. That's all we're saying.
It's the WKB approximation, right? I mean, it gives you some particular set of classical solutions. I give every single one that's a solution of the equation of motion. That's all we're saying.
It's a little surprising.
It was surprising to us also.
Okay.
Is there some coarse grading issue here? I mean, if I had one of these trajectories which is not classical. Okay. I might think it looks like a de Sitter space with some small perturbation. I might think that. Is the statement that, no, it doesn't look like that, the de Sitter space is completely quantum mechanical, there's no rough metric there. Or is the statement something more subtle, like the perturbations to de Sitter sourced by the scalar field are not particularly classical, you know, that their quantum fluctuations are the same size as their amplitude, but there is still a background de Sitter space I could talk about. Do we know how non-classical these solutions are?
But there is no background to Sitter space necessarily. If you have these small scalar field fluctuations and the cosmological constant is very small, then they will destroy your de Sitter space.
No,
that is why we have classical solutions when mu is small. When mu is small...
Why do they destroy your de Sitter space, is my question.
Well, because the dynamics need not be dominated by a very small cosmological constant.
I think the problem is that we're talking about two different things. You're talking about properties of this particular state. It's no boundary state.
Sure. Yeah.
And you're calculating everything based on the no boundary state. And then you're getting this result that some classical solutions just have zero probability.
Are predicted by the no boundary state.
Yeah. In fact, I think the following slide, I think the next slide will clarify.
So it's not, I mean, you're not saying that there don't exist.
No, not at all. No.
It's classical.
Not at all. In fact, I think the next slide will clarify this. So then you can take that ensemble which we got with non-zero probabilities. Well, those complex solutions specify Cauchy data on that boundary and evolve these forward and backwards and see, well, what are they look like. It turns out that all of these, that in order for the classicality condition to hold, the complex history is always inflating. So there is a connection somehow between the requirement of regularity, the no boundary condition, and the slow roll condition in the Lorentzian history. And then if you go back to the potential, well, we all know that the slow roll condition does not hold here, okay? The system is dominated by the kinetic energy or the gradient energy of the scalar field. Inflation is not possible when phi is less than 1 or 2. And so this is what we find, that bound on phi naught translates, well, not quite, but almost in the slow roll condition bound in conventional Lorentzian cosmology. So that at least is a physical, an interesting connection, I think, between the regularity condition at the South Pole and what actually happens. So that's just a sample of different histories which we get from taking this Cauchy data and evolving forward and backwards. And time runs, time runs forwards like this, okay? So the scalar field runs down the potential. But this is a very special set of cosmologies, okay? If you take a generic cosmology at late times and you evolve it backwards, you will see something like this. Okay, so the field will remain to be kinetically dominated by kinetic energy. But it turns out that for all phi knots, all these histories come together and go to late times in a narrow band around the inflationary trajectory. So that is a very important consequence, because it means that if we go back to our phase space, the no boundary wave functions is a band which is precisely inside the band of inflating histories. And that band of inflating histories is very, very narrow, e to the minus 3 n in some flat a priori measure, as was discussed by Gary and Neil, right? In fact, the conclusions they draw from their work using a flat prior on classical phase space is that, well, inflation is very unlikely, a priori very improbable. So this is clear, and the moral conclusion is that, from their paper, is that, well, you need a quantum state to explain why inflation happened. And you see this happening here.
Inflation, in your sense, means slow roll inflation.
Sure.
And is that what Gibbons and Turok were talking about as well? I mean, my confusion is just, you have a background cosmological constant. Surely most states have some exponential expansion from the cosmological constant.
Okay, so exactly the same result holds for an m squared phi squared potential.
Without
cosmological constant. In fact, perhaps for this talk I should have set the cosmological constant to zero. In fact, the curve...
I mean, there is an instanton with much smaller action where you tunnel just directly to the bottom.
Okay. You have one classical history which is at the bottom.
And you throw, and that has a huge action compared to the other one, because it goes as the one over that cosmological constant. So, but you throw that out because it's not classical.
Oh, it's clear. Sitting exactly at the bottom is certainly a classical solution. Yes, I throw it out on just reasonable, being reasonable.
What do you mean being reasonable? Just because it measures zero, or just what?
Well.
By reasonable, do you mean anthropic? I mean, I'm sure.
Well, I don't throw it out for now. Just yeah, you can put it in. It's gonna go away later. Then, yeah.
But your statement is, if you include that, it just gives you one more dot on this line. You
can't. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so there will be some dot there.
Well,
yeah.
But I mean, it doesn't have zero width. I mean, if you're a little bit away, you're still. But that, I mean, you know, that's a weak argument, because it has such a huge action advantage. It doesn't hurt it to pay a penalty of a small width.
Yes, but what are you going to do with a small width? You're going to... Once you want to create... Well, it is going to go away later, right? When we compute probabilities for observation. But... okay, so wait. So where was I? Yes. So this is an important point. I wanted to... Yes, in response to Don's question. This curve here... the one most on the right for you is the curve which you get from a pure m squared phi squared model without cosmological constant and same value for the mass. Okay, so the situation is very analogous. Okay, so here is just a summary of these homogeneous isotropic histories, sort of a phase space diagram, if you wish. We label these by phi naught. And then we have our free parameter specifying the theory, which is mu. And so mu is large for realistic values. We've seen that you do not have classical solutions predicted by the no boundary wave function when phi naught is small. Then you have a band of solutions which are initially singular and then recollapse. These are solutions with a few refoldings of inflation. Then you have solutions which expand forever. That is a feature, of course, which comes from the cosmological constant. You have inflation, and then the cosmological constant takes over before the universe can recollapse again. And then you have solutions which have no singularity in the past. Okay, so this is cool. And they have a lot of inflation, so they're really just like our universe. So you can wonder, well, what about this theorem? And... this theorem doesn't apply. And I'll explain why.
You have a cosmological constant. You have a positive.
No.
Actually, you have scalar potential. The singularity theorem, test singularity theorems.
Oh, yeah, of course. But the theorem of Bordet and Wilenkin, which I thought you were referring to, says that inflationary cosmologies are generically singular in the past. If the cosmological constant goes away, if the cosmological constant goes away, this goes away, expansion forever, that goes away.
Okay.
But this remains the same. And the theorem does not apply because it assumes something about the arrow of time, which need not be valid, apparently, as we find here, and to which I will come back.
Internally inflating. That's what you're saying. They had a theorem that if you have internal inflation, then it's the singularity in the past. I mean, there's an older theorem due to Hawking and just singularity theorems that predicted a singularity in our past, but that probably doesn't apply because of energy.
Oh, no, that doesn't apply, clearly. No.
Does this new theorem really predict the singularity in the past? The theorem that I know of says inflation is not past infinite, which has a certain technical meaning. And it talks about. Is that the theorem we're talking about?
Okay. I think that's the theorem we're talking about.
Okay,
so that presumably...
And in their discussion, if you have one of these balanced universes, they call that not past infinite.
Okay, yeah, that's probably correct. Yeah.
Actually, I was thinking of Hawking, but I guess you would say in any inflationary universe, Hawking's theorem isn't relevant because... We should just forget about it. We should take away his Nobel Prize because it's not relevant anymore.
You know more than I do. Okay, so now then, well, as I mentioned earlier, with each member in the ensemble predicted by the no-boundary wave function, the probability is given by the real part of the Euclidean action of the wave function. So you can calculate this, and then you can combine the information you have from the Lorentzian evolution with the probabilities that you get from the Euclidean action. And so you see, well, as Joe was pointing out, a priori low phi naught solutions are more likely, and the phi naught equals zero solution will be somewhere there. This dotted line signals the transition from solutions which are singular to ones at large phi naught, which are regular in the past. And then here we just have the number of e-foldings as a function of phi naught. Larger phi naught means larger chi, means more e-folding. So that's all fairly obvious. And the real part of the Euclidean action, the slope goes like 1 over phi naught squared. So a priori, histories with a small number of e-foldings are more probable. But those probabilities are just the priors, okay? Now we're going to compute things which we observe. So the priors we have already, these are probabilities for entire histories. But it's a crucial feature in cosmology that observations are restricted to a part of a past light cone in some spacetime. The light cone extends, roughly speaking, over a Hubble volume. And it's located somewhere in space. Okay, it's a feature of cosmology that we do local observations. So the probabilities for observations, say we want to observe O, some quantity, the CMB spectrum, are necessarily conditioned on a description of the local observational situation. Say that we call the data that goes into this situation D. Here is an example, an observation of the CMB spectrum. So WMAP looks out, and it measures the temperature in all different directions of the sky. When you go to... So that clearly, that observation of the temperature in each direction depends on when and where the observation is made. Then you can do statistics, and then, of course, you can get averages quantities, but the observations themselves are conditional probabilities. So those conditional probabilities is what we're really interested in to test the theory. And they're obtained by summing the probabilities for the prior probabilities over all histories which contain these data. So this can be worked out explicitly. So, but we have to be a little bit more precise about what we mean by this data. And so let's assume that this data consists of observations that put us on a space-like surface, say the last scattering surface, and local observations that observations that localize us on this surface. So then the probability, the data consists of these two parts. And so that's given by the joint probability over the probability that these local data occur. Now remember, these probabilities are probabilities for these local data. All we know from our observation is that these data, which we assume occur at least in one Hubble volume. Okay. But these are probabilities which are probabilities that are for the entire ensemble. Okay. So we have to sum over all histories in the ensemble to get this probability. We're asking for the probability that these data happen at least once in a Hubble volume in each possible history of the ensemble. If there's only one history, then this integral will go away and you predict one particular history of your ensemble. So here we have the prior probability of the histories coming in. And then this conditional probability, the probability that the data occurs at least one time, well, that's 1 minus the probability that these data occur in none of the Hubble volumes in the history. Okay, and so PE here is just the probability that our data appear in any one of the Hubble volumes. And H here is the number of Hubble volumes on the surface. So similarly for the numerator, the conditional probability in the ensemble is an integral over all members, which are labeled by phi naught, of the conditional of the prior probability for the observation times the probability that the data occur. So we can put this together. That gives you a complicated formula. But if the data which we assume in our conditional probability are such that they do not occur in every Hubble volume, so say for instance the CMB observation, these are 10 to the 5 pixels, it's very unlikely that in the next Hubble volume the same temperature are observed. If the data are, in other words, rare with respect to the number of Hubble volumes on the surface, in the whole range of phi naught, in the whole ensemble, then this complicated formula reduces to, so then PE is very small, okay? So then you just take the first term in this expansion and you get NH times PE, but you get PE also in the denominator, so the probability PE drops out. And you're left with this formula, which is essentially, that's just a normalization factor here. What is this formula? It's nothing but the original prior probabilities multiplied by the number of Hubble volumes in each history. Okay? So that's volume weighted, essentially. To get these probabilities, you volume weight the prior no-boundary probabilities. So we can now apply this to a very simple question, the probability simply of a number of V-foldings or equivalently phi naught given some data which refer to our local observational situation. Well, that will be nothing but the volume of a homogeneous surface multiplied by the prior probability, which is just Euclidean action. So here you see that this has a large effect. The prior probability favored low phi, and the volume-weighted probability favors large phi, certainly if you require... why does it favor large phi? Because these universes are such short-lived that the surface of last scattering doesn't even exist, okay? They're already recollapsed. So the integral over phi not on the previous slide is restricted to histories where that surface exists. And so you see the important feature of this probability distribution is, well, it favors a lot of inflation, but it has this positive gradient in the regime where V is larger than epsilon, and epsilon is the slow roll parameter. Epsilon is phi dot over V. So in the case of our model, for instance, this is phi not greater than 1 over root m. So m is small, so that's a large value. And here is the Planck density. The Planck density you have when phi naught is equal to 1 over m. So you have a whole range of phi naughts where the gradient of the probability distribution is positive. And so large phi naught histories are favored. So some of you will notice that this condition is precisely the condition where eternal inflation happens. So that is the statement that quantum fluctuations of the scalar field can compensate for the classical roll down. So that is precisely the regime, it coincides with the regime where the volume factor has a large effect. Now it has all...
I would have thought it was a similar condition, but the condition you talked about has some weighting based on some given set of data from the CMB and so forth, whereas in the eternal inflation case, you're comparing a large volume to some tunneling probability.
Yeah. In their case, the condition arises from a completely different reasoning.
Right.
I'm just pointing out that this is the condition we are having here, is similar to... Or is the same as the condition for which
you both V greater than epsilon, but the epsilons are different.
No, the epsilon is the same.
The same.
Yeah, just the same. I don't understand why these conditions are the same. I'm just pointing out they are the same. But they arise they're derived in very different ways. So
I'll ask you that one.
So this, I mean, and when you have eternal inflation, so at the same time you may get worried about this condition, because statements have been made that in the regime of eternal inflation, constant phi surfaces are so perturbed that they actually may be, that their volume may become infinite. So then the number of Hubble volumes in our formula would be infinite, and so the volumating of course would break down. But the point is that this volumating arises only in a certain regime. Okay? When the number of Hubble volumes on your constant phi surface becomes large, you have to go back to the more general weighting. And when you go back to the more general weighting, you find that even in infinite universes, this is normalizable and well-defined. And in particular, in the limit where the number of Hubble volumes is so large that PEE is... I mean, that we're common and not rare, then the conditional probability is just reduced to the prior probabilities which we had before.
The size of the universe is just large enough that we appear once. Is that the idea?
Very good point. Yeah, so I think indeed, take a value for PE, and the history that you will predict is there, where we just appear once.
The history that you would predict particularly has eternal inflation. So yeah. Then we're going to appear many times.
No. Yes, but...
So if you ignored eternal inflation, you would appear once, but you say that eternal inflation comes in at the same place.
Well, okay, but then you have to do a more complete analysis, including perturbations.
Right.
I will come to that. Yeah. Of course, if the universe is infinite, then the whole point is that this measure is well defined, but we appear many times.
Sure.
So what is the timing effect?
It's 3 o'clock.
3 o'clock. I see.
Five.
I see. Okay. Okay. So I'll be brief about this. Wait.
As far as the same talk I gave last week.
How come there's so many questions?
You've got many more questions, but then I had David
Rosen do it. Well, 10 more minutes or so?
Yeah, you certainly can go on for 10 minutes.
Okay. So I'll deflect. Let me be very brief about the prior probability distribution for the fluctuations, because that's, I mean, the new physics comes in when we compute conditional probabilities. Okay. The prior probability distribution is you perturb your metric, you decompose in modes, and you fix the gauge, so that in the end you have one scalar perturbation left, which is a combination of the scalar field perturbation and the metric scalar perturbation. So the wave function is gauge invariant and depends only on this one true degree of scalar degree of freedom. So the game is the same. You have to impose regularity on these fluctuations at the south pole and match these at the boundary to real values. So you compute again the wave function in the same classical approximation using saddle points and solving these complex equations for the fluctuations. Just as with the background, the fluctuations or the different histories for the fluctuations will be labeled by the absolute value of the complex constant that characterizes the perturbations near the south pole. So zeta and O labels the histories for each background phi naught and for each perturbation mode. So then there are two regimes. You're interested in fluctuations which leave the horizon. Okay, these are the ones that lead to structure formation. So for a while, when the background expands and the scalar field rolls down, the fluctuations will be oscillating as long as they're inside the horizon, as long as the wavelength is smaller than the Hubble radius. So here you see this happening. That's the matter fluctuation oscillates with a decreasing amplitude. The gauge invariant fluctuation oscillates too. And if you compute the action using this gauge invariant fluctuation, you find that the Euclidean action also oscillates with a constant amplitude. But then, at some point, the wavelength will become equal to the horizon, and then the nature of the solutions changes. They stop oscillating, and on superhorizon scales, you have a slowly growing solution for the fluctuations and a decaying solution. Both are again complex, okay? And these complex proportionality constants here are determined by matching onto the complex solutions that you get on superhorizon scales, and of course also by the requirement that at your final boundary the perturbation has to be real. Okay? So that fixes the transition from sup to superhorizon. So here you see this happening. The matter fluctuation oscillates. It oscillates here, and at the horizon it freezes and it begins to slowly grow. Then at the end of inflation, the matter fluctuation will oscillate again, but the scalar metric perturbation will be essentially constant. And this is the guy that's essentially conserved on superhorizon scales and determines the amplitude of ultimately the CMB fluctuations. So as I said, we tune the phase of the fluctuation at the south pole so that the fluctuation is real at the final boundary. Essentially what this means is that the whole complex part of the gauge invariant fluctuation is put into the decaying mode. Okay? And when you do so, you find that the gradients of the real to the imagined part of the Euclidean action decay. So in other words, that that transition from sup to superhorizon goes together with the transition from the fluctuation being quantum to classical. As that's obvious, you, by tuning that complex imaginary part into the decaying mode, you've lost the information about the phase of the perturbation. And at that transition, when the fluctuation becomes classical, the Euclidean action reaches the following constant, where all these quantities have to be evaluated when the particular mode leaves the horizon. So when you have this, once the Euclidean action becomes constant, the wave function on superhorizon scale, when the modulus on superhorizon scales doesn't change anymore. So this gives you the wave function, which is relevant to calculate all sorts of conditional probabilities, just as before.
But do you still assume that there's an actual time, a particular slice, where the perturbation is real everywhere, I mean, on all scales? It's not an asymptotic statement, right? I mean, the no boundary wave function, I thought, said you have a particular surface, certain size, certain value of the scalar field, and a certain perturbation.
Yeah.
And you want your perturbation, I thought, to be real everywhere.
Sure, but then, but then we do the same as we were doing before. Uh-huh. We take the Cauchy data
and then evolve it.
And evolve with the Lorentzian equations.
Right. Okay.
So then the Euclidean action is, the real part is, of course, constant. And so same process as before. Yeah, all this is saying that this condition and all that allows you to do that matching and to proceed as before. Taking, of course, the real part of Euclidean action with you, because that provides the probability. So now let's look at probabilities for observations, conditioned, again, on the local observational situation. And assuming, for the moment, that we are rare, then these prior probability distributions for the fluctuations are volume-weighted. And we're interested in probabilities for the fluctuations on constant scalar field surfaces, right? A constant scalar field surface evolves to the reheating surface, which becomes a constant temperature surface. The constant temperature surface evolves forward to the large scattering surface, which is a constant temperature surface. And then the variations in the temperature that we observe are due to the redshift of the last scattering surface being different in different directions. Okay? So it's convenient to evaluate this probability in the constant scalar field gauge, in which the gauge invariant fluctuation is essentially the scalar metric perturbation. And so the overall amplitude predicted from the prior probability distribution is given by that gauge invariant perturbation, by the scalar metric perturbation. And all these quantities are, of course, evaluated at horizon crossing of that particular mode. And so you see, again, it's V over epsilon. This is the famous result which tunes the mass of the scalar field to be 10 to the minus 5. And you see, it's again the Eterne inflation condition in a way. When this is of order 1, Eterne inflation is there. What does this mean, among other things? It means that the fluctuations, the temperature fluctuations that you would observe, are of order 1. So in that regime, perturbation theory would break down. So, but that's just the standard result about which you get from the prior probabilities, right? And now let's go back to that conditional probability, and let's restrict attention for simplicity to a given history, background history, a given phi naught. Then we're interested for temperature fluctuations in that sort of quantities, but there's a prefactor which arises from the... So what we have here is the prior probability distribution for the fluctuation multiplied by the perturbed volume, by the number of Hubble volumes. So that's the perturbed volume factor is what gives you this prefactor. And then you can plot this, and what you see here is the conditional probability for a fluctuation mode that leaves the horizon while the Eterne inflation condition holds, so for large phi naught and not too large n. And you see that, in other words, you see that this volume factor has a large effect also on the fluctuations. This is the prior probability distribution, and that is the probability distribution for what we observe. And again, that dip arises exactly again when the Eterne inflation condition holds. So that's a non-Gaussian signature in the fluctuation spectrum, just in an M squared phi squared model, which you get by summing over different histories. Okay? It's the sum over different histories that gives you the volume factor, and it's the volume factor that gives you non-Gaussianity. But it's presumably only observable on very, very large scales. So in other words, at a very late time.
Sorry, very large means outside our horizon?
Currently outside of our horizon. Because currently, V over epsilon is 10 to the minus 10.
Right, right.
But if we wait a long time, and assuming the inflation happened way back in the inflation regime, then you see it. Well, it's there now too, but it's just a very, very, very small flattening of the Gaussian spectrum. See what I mean?
What determines when it becomes visible? I mean, what's the domain?
Well, when it... Okay.
It has to be long after the most can do that. Okay.
Yeah, what determines it? What do you mean, on what scales it becomes visible? Yeah, it's the interplay between the volume factor and the Gaussian probability distribution. I can't really say it more precisely, I think. Okay, but maybe I should... wait, okay. So I had some comments on the arrow of time. Clearly, what's happening in these histories is that at the bounds, the arrow, so the fluctuations grow. At the bounds, the fluctuations are small in the large finite histories, and they grow on both sides of the bounds. So in that sense, inflation is not past eternal. Inflation is happening on both sides in opposite directions. Then the implications for vacuum selection are clear. You can easily extend this to a landscape potential, and the key point being is that within this approximation, only those vacua which admit inflation will be populated. But all of them will be populated, I think. Even those, so I found this patch of the potential in a paper by Kalosh, where it was argued, well, here it would be really good if you can get there, but typically, when you populate your landscape in a chaotic way, you will zoom over it. Mm-hmm. But here, this is not the case. Those flat patches will have a significant probability for the universe to arise there. And then if you roll down, and so you can just have your cosmology there. So it populates patches of the landscape, but I think in a slightly different way from eternal inflation. So OK, I will leave that for you to read. Stop here, I think.
This report with the data appear at least once bothers me logically, because if I then specify my data twice as accurately, you're going to predict that the universe is twice as large, and it shouldn't depend on that.
Right. So we worked hard to get to conditional probabilities where that specification drops out, and it does drop out.
Okay.
If you specify your local observational situation sufficiently accurately. That is, yeah,
okay.
That's what comes in. I agree. It's natural in a way. It's necessarily the case, but the accuracy is indeed some with which you define PE. So that's why I'm here. Just in generally, I'm saying. To in this whole thing, it requires you to take an observer's perspective. But
it's not an option, right? I mean, if you're going to agree that we're in the universe, and there were physical systems described within it, and we want to describe our observations, then you have to put.
But do I have to agree that we're not typical? What that measure is, we're not typical measure.
The issue of typicality arises
because you don't get a bonus for appearing 10 times.
That's right.
So that was an assumption.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's not an assumption.
I think you do get a bonus for appearing 10 times.
Right, but not here, indeed. And this is a crucial difference with other measures that have been.
Because all we know is that we have one instance of our data. That's what we're conditioning.
So in principle, that appearing 10 times is already there. You see, that's what gives rise to the volume factor.
In fact, the appearing 10 times are the higher powers in 1 minus p e to the number of
public. That's right. Yeah.
Wait, sorry, say it again. Period 10 times.
Well,
so if there's a probability for the probability to appear once is like PE, and the probability to appear twice is PE squared, and so forth. And so they're exactly the higher order terms in that formula.
Yeah,
all that's being taken into account.
That comes from appearing 10 times, and that's what gives you the volume factor in the end. That n is the volume factor.
So I didn't quite understand all your comments on kernel inflation. You seem to say that Wannes effects kick in the same regime you expected kernel inflation, but of course, it sounds like even in the second part of the talk, you have not taken those effects into account. You have not done a calculation that includes kernel inflation. Is that right?
That.
You have not done a calculation that includes eternal inflation.
I think we have it.
Well, I'd just like to offer a conjecture here. I think by eternal inflation, Don means totally eternal inflation, right?
Oh, well, I see. Possible?
No.
You haven't done that. That's true.
So there was a part that I didn't catch the details of, but I thought the claim was that when this wave function turns over and the part that is emphasized by the volume weighting, it's likely that eternal inflation will occur.
Yes, but what do you mean by eternal inflation?
I mean that some patch of the universe will continue inflating forever.
Right. Okay. So this is taken into account in our conditional
code. Account.
Yeah. It's taken into account in our measure. Our measure is clearly well defined, even if the surface of constant phi becomes infinitely large. What is not taken into account is the fact that another feature of eternal inflation is that just the CMB fluctuations will be large. Okay? If eternal inflation happens on a mode which is currently observable, so say in the far future. So this would require you to do a non-perturbative perturbation analysis even to get the spectrum right.
Yeah.
And so for that we have just done the perturbation, the first order in perturbation theory. Wait, where is it? Which gives you this, okay? This is a graph of the prediction in the eternal inflating regime, but using perturbation theory.
Do you think that's reliable? Is one of my questions.
Well, it depends on if I take one mode, yes. So for some coarse-grained quantity or some smoothed-out quantity, that's reliable. To get the CMB spectrum, which involves all modes, it won't be reliable. No.
I also don't understand what it means when you say your measure is well defined when the volume of the surface is infinite. If the volume of the surface is infinite, I would have thought that if I give you some data so far and ask you to predict some additional feature, that because the surface is infinite, those features appear infinitely many times along the surface.
Sure.
So the probability they exist at least once is one, and in that sense, the measure is well defined.
Sure.
Is that what
you're saying
that means?
What doesn't blow up?
Yeah, it doesn't blow up. I mean, the problem with eternal inflation, the other measures of eternal inflation, is that in an infinite universe, they weight by the volume, which is infinite.
But what I want to understand.
We only weight by the volume till a certain extent.
But this, on a truly infinite universe, your measure gives one, probably one for everything. Is that correct? Okay, all right.
One for everything? No. No.
Well, if one minus PE to the n, and n is very large, then it gives the probability is one.
Yes, okay, so but then you... Okay, but then you have the bottom-up probabilities.
Give the what?
It means that then you have the prior probabilities. Yeah, sure. It leads to falsifiable predictions, even in an infinite universe.
I don't understand that. How is that?
Well,
where does it come from? What are these bottom-up probabilities in your formula?
That's the general formula, right? This is the... Okay.
Yeah.
So here, those probabilities are calculable from the theory. That's just...
So, I guess I don't know what that is. P of F given by zero?
Right, so that is the probability for observing something on a surface, on an infinite surface. The probability distribution for the fluctuations, say.
Okay.
in an open universe. That's certainly calculable from the perturbation analysis that I gave. This is the volume factor, okay? So that will...
That's what it is.
That's one.
Yeah.
But isn't that first part one as well? If I give you an infinite surface and ask for the probability that some fluctuations f appear in some Hubble volume on that surface?
No.
How global f is?
Oh, he says you imagine specifying f not just in one Hubble volume, but in fact everywhere.
Yeah. But for example, the calculation of a very large scale structure extends over anywhere.
That is just this, right? That is just psi as a function of b, chi, and fluctuations on some...
I was attempting to predict the observations we'll make next year or the next 10 years, which involves some local region. And
right.
Local specification of f, then that then p of f given ds and phi 0 would be 1. It'll happen someplace on the surface.
Well, the interesting probabilities are usually then the correlations in our data that we already have in one right place. So I don't think those are going to be in Earth. They won't be replicated. At any rate, another way of saying the point is
right,
that with this measure, right, if NH becomes very large, we don't need some additional regulation of the formula for regulating. We just calculate whatever the answer.
I'm still confused about whether the answer is a useful answer for the kind of things that we're like.
Useful.
So maybe we keep an additional question for private discussion and thanks.